Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murders. Today, we're bringing you part one of our two-part series on French serial killer Dr. Marcel Patou. This insane story takes place in Paris under German occupation during World War II. It features a house of horrors, French resistance fighters, the Gestapo, German torture prisons, unbelievable scams, the fog of war, and words I literally can't pronounce. Like, I waited tables for most of my adult life, and French wine labels turned me into Jim Carrey from Liar Liar. If you know, you know, right? Right? And I'm going to try my best.
Yeah.
I wrote everything down phonetically and Googled all of the stupid. I do this all the time just for people who know, and they laugh and they say, oh, you pronounced that wrong.
Yeah.
I Google.
She tries.
I Google the pronunciations and then write them down phonetically. Uh-huh. And I still do them totally wrong 1,000 times an episode. So I do try, but I'm a clown. I'm naturally a clown. It's a part of my thing. And sometimes when in my head,
yeah,
I just say it. It's a way. And then I'll be like, great. And then that's the way it is forever. So
right.
Whatever.
Okay. So we're giving all those French people with lots of reasons to already make fun of Americans even more ammunition.
If you know, it's the thing about Liar Liar when they say he can't tell a lie. So when he tries to lie, he pushes out like that. That's what I sound like when I try to say French words. And so just know that, and just know that it's been this way for me for 20 years.
Yeah. Shout out to all of our French listeners.
For this series, I read the book, The Unspeakable Crimes of Dr. Patou by Thomas Mader. I literally couldn't recommend this book enough. It is so, so excellent. I'm doing a very fun, like, quickie version of this story.
Yeah.
But if this story interests you, which it should, his book is a great read. It's about 350 pages. He does an in-depth, beautiful job. It's brilliant. Mm-hmm. I just highly suggest you read it. I think it's so underrated. I hadn't heard of it, and I couldn't recommend it enough. Totally go out there and read it.
Cool. And some of you should. I'm not going to, but just for the record, that recommendation, it's so funny. I've literally never considered any of those recommendations for me. You don't mean them for me, right? You mean them for our listeners. We've been doing this podcast for like 2.5 years, and it just now occurred to me.
You don't like true crime books. I'm never going to recommend them.
Okay. Okay. Good. Good.
You only like them when I like that trope or the joke that you only like them when I tell you.
Yeah.
It's literally true.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay.
I know that about you. I'm just saying, like, there's a lot of stuff I couldn't get into.
Yeah.
That it's a pretty dense, complicated book, and I'm kind of pulling out the main threads of like of the story of this book. So there's a lot of stuff that I had to leave out, and the book goes into more in-depth stuff. And I would, if you want to know more about it, I would recommend reading
it. And when she says you, she means you, the listener, not me.
You.
Yeah, not me. Okay, good. I know. I just had a momentary lapse of intelligence. I was like, are you like on the secret campaign to one day catch me actually reading a true crime book?
No, baby. Okay, I know you're good.
All right. Okay. Okay. But now we have an overt campaign to thank Katie B for increasing her monthly Patreon pledge.
What did she increase it to, Nick?
666, baby.
666. I love that. That was so funny.
I know. That's Katie B just put out the satanic challenge to all you guys.
Yeah.
Increasing or signing up for 666.
We just got a little push notification on our phone.
Hilarious.
666.
Beautiful.
So, thank you.
Look, your continued support is huge for us. Thank you to everyone that stays subscribed month in and month out. Those dollars make it possible for us to put put in the hours it takes for Muriel to research and write these episodes. If you're a regular listener who can afford another subscription all up in your bush and you want to see this show and the two of us thrive, please subscribe to Muriel's Murders Patreon or through Spotify. Unlock exclusive episodes and let's elevate together.
Yeah. You know? And I'm bringing you part two early-ish for our Patreon subscribers. I think we're going to release it probably on Friday.
Okay, cool.
Like Thursday night or Friday.
Great.
So it won't be, we try to do the part twos like the same day we release these, but life gets in the way and it's our wedding anniversary on Wednesday. So we're just kind of being little lazy bums.
Yep.
But you'll get it. Patreon subscribers will get it a few days earlier.
Yes.
Oh, Nikki.
Yes.
Do we need to give Valley Girl a shout out?
We sure do. Alisa, what is up? We love Valley Girl. Check out Valley Girl on Instagram. She's been rocking with us back in the day when we were doing Hell in Your 30s. She found us there. She's been rocking with Muriel's Murders all these years. An amazing graphic designer, artist. And she makes zines, which is very true to my heart. Check out Valley Girl on Instagram. We just owe her a special shout out. Damn, does it feel good.
I always say this, but she made my favorite enamel pin. Like, I don't wear any jewelry and I don't have any pins, but I have this one pin that I wear that's a clown that says whatever. It's my favorite thing in the entire world.
Yeah, and I wear her her Flaming Hot Cheetos pin that in the Cheetos letters it says no chill. Love it.
They're both just literally pin manifestations of our personality. This is a true story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc. So if any listeners are like Nick and they don't want to hear about those kind of things, go listen to a different podcast, you weirdo.
Plus, we joke about true crimes and we tend to curse. And some of that stuff can be upsetting for you. If you're one of those people, turn us off.
Okay. Nikki, are you ready to hear this story?
No.
Okay, let's get started.
I tried to say no in French and it just came out no.
Okay. I think that's how you say no in French.
I know.
And you also took French in high school.
We do not need to talk about me and all my French teachers. I have.
And you took it in college, didn't you?
What'd you say?
Didn't you take it in college?
I did take it at Seattle Central Community College. I had very, in retrospect and at the time, inappropriate relationships with pretty much every foreign language teacher I ever studied with. Yeah, so but we don't need to go into that. This isn't
you're
therapy.
So cute.
Yeah, but I was okay. Anyways, we're gonna keep it moving. Lord forbid you were a lady teaching French or Italian. I walked into your class. Woo! We were gonna have some interactions. Okay.
Oh my god. All right. So yes. This story starts on March 11th, 1944, in the 16th arrondissement in Paris, France. So that's a district.
Okay.
We're talking about like a super classy, wealthy, high society section of the city, which it was partially expressed in like a glut of space and gorgeous architecture. So you're talking large avenues, parks, museums, and one of the only areas in Paris where you'd see bigger gated communities with like huge gardens and yards and villas, stuff like that.
Amazing, beautiful.
However, the great equalizer at the time was World War II. Mm. So the city was under German occupation and had been for about 4 years at this point. And while liberation for Paris was about 5 years, or I'm sorry, 5 months away, the crushing war at this point was just dragging on. People disappeared. Mm. There were bombings. The Gestapo lurked. Citywide blackouts extinguished the city of lights. There was food rationing. And all that didn't spare the posh 16th arrondissement. Mm-hmm. One of the prominent homes in the area was the grand three-story property on 21 Rue Le Sueur.
Oh my God.
The former home of Princess Maria Colloredo de Mansfeld. Like everything else at the time, it had faded from its former glory. The princess had moved out about 15 years prior and sold the building to a doctor back in 1941, who left it vacant for the most part after erecting really high walls to block the neighbors' views into the courtyard. So the comings and goings at the Princess House were casually interesting to bored, posh neighbors and became a point of neighborhood gossip. For instance, while no one lived there, there was like a man in workman's clothes who rode a bicycle up to the house almost every day, towing a wagon. That was hot goss.
Okay.
One time, workers with trucks removed an inordinate amount of suitcases from the property. A nosy neighbor lady counted 47.
That is nosy.
It was pretty nosy. Someone also saw workers drop off 30 to 40 filled sacks to the coach house once, right? They're just counting stuff. I mean, there's nothing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
For the past 6 months, there had been also a late night horse-drawn cart visiting the street near the Princess House every night. But because the city would shut off electricity to sort of block bombing attempts by Allied forces, no one actually saw what the horse cart was up to. They could just hear it, you know. So they were like, "Okay, this thing is going on," but they can't really say it's going to the
just the out. Clopping along the cobblestones.
Yeah, exactly. You know. Oh, well, have you heard? Right. Anyway, on March 11th, 1944, the Princess House went from being a casual neighborhood mystery to a nuisance. For the past 5 days, thick, stinky, black smoke had been pouring out of the chimney, choking up the neighborhood and getting into everyone's fancy houses. And on March 11th, neighbors were sick of the smoke and decided to talk to the doctor about it. But when neighbors went to the Princess House, they found the house shuttered and locked tight with a note on the door with a forwarding address explaining Dr. Patu would be out of town for a month, right? So they were like, is this a house fire? Was there a caretaker there doing burning? Like, what was going on? It's worried.
Human bodies.
Worried that maybe it was an uncontrolled chimney fire. Neighbors called the police, who came with the fire department, who also called Dr. Patu at his other apartment in the city. And Dr. Patu answers the phone and he says, okay, did you go inside the house? No. Good. Don't go inside the house. I'll be there in 15 minutes. Don't touch anything. After 30 minutes, the smoke got worse. There's no sign of the doctor. So the fire chief climbed up to a second story window, forced his way inside, and they go outside to see what's going on. And they followed the stinky smoke down to the basement. And a few minutes later, because it's a pretty like sprawled out house, there's lots of outbuildings and stuff like that. They bust out of a door in the coach house that's like an outbuilding kind of like down the street. And they're throwing up and they're horrified. So police go in the way the firefighters came out and they find the culprit, a coal burning stove going full blast with a human hand dangling out the door.
Come on.
And nearby there's like a pile of coal.
No.
And a pile of skulls.
Great.
There's a pile of skeletons.
Come on.
Piles of bones. There's chunks of rotting flesh. Hands straight up Sweeney Todd.
Damn. Just someone just chopping up people and burning them.
Yeah. So just then, a man rode up on a bicycle describing himself as the brother of Dr. Patu. Super annoyed that people were now inside the house. So they bring the guy down into the basement. They show this guy all the body parts. They bring him up to the street and they're like, okay, man, what's this all about?
Yeah, WTF, however you say that in French. Come si dice.
That's Italian. Well, you know. No, maybe you don't know. And the man turns to the police and he says, you know, are you guys French? And the police are super offended and they say, yes, yes, of course. How dare you? Also, what does that have to do with anything? The man basically says, what you're looking at, gentlemen, are the bodies of Germans, enemies of the French. I'm the leader of a French resistance group. I'm sure you've already radioed this in and the Germans are on their way. What you have to understand is I have hundreds of files at my apartment, like related to this French resistance group. I need to destroy them before the Germans get to them.
Okay. I'm already not trusting his story.
So here's the thing.
Yeah.
Back when the German occupation of France started in 1941, the Germans basically offered French police the opportunity to stay in their posts. And most decided to stay. So they would stay in their posts kind of under the direction of the Germans, mm-hmm. feeling like they were choosing the better of two evils, that at least they'd be able to stay and like resolve things between the French in the French way, and then also be able to sabotage stuff if the opportunity arose.
Right, because it's either stay in or now just we will be the police and you guys are gone completely.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. And then also maybe possibly support resistance fighters if given the opportunity. Mm. And also, in this neighborhood in particular, there just were a lot of Germans, right? There was a German brothel around the corner. There was Gestapo were like patrolling a lot in the area. And I believe there was like a Gestapo headquarters.
Which is what? The police sort of spy agency of the Nazi party?
Yes.
Okay.
And police put two and two together. So first, there were a lot of Germans on hand. And then second, a murder den this large and complicated must belong to some sort of organized group, right?
Right.
So the most reasonable explanation is the guy on the bike is telling the truth.
But they never tell the truth. The guy on the bike is always a liar.
So
the first one, oh, this is my brother, you shouldn't go in there. Oh no, actually we're killing people that you really want dead.
So police, they took all this into consideration. They just winked and nodded and were like, get out of here, you crazy kid. And Dr. Patu, who was pretending to be his brother, just said, okay, cool, man. Got on his bike and rode off scot-free. Police now turn their attention to this resistance headquarters,
yeah.
Right? Allegedly. So the house was huge, kind of Downton Abbey style, not that big, right? But not quite a manor like that, but it still had like six salons, right? And a library.
What the hell is a salon?
Just places where people are chilling, you know, like beautiful, beautiful places to chill, you know, where everybody's sitting there reading books or whatever. like a huge walled in lawn. Every room though was filled with dusty old furniture and trash. Nothing had been lived in for, you know, years.
Mm-hmm.
There were several outbuildings, servants' quarters, the coach house, stables, a second library. And then, oddly, out in the outbuildings, a small, cramped, pristinely kept doctor's consultation room, fully stocked and functional, clearly actively in use. And in the garage next to the room, officers found an absurdly large pile of quicklime filled with chunks of rotting corpses. So a whole nother room just full of corpses that they hadn't found.
Wait, before. What do you mean? Like a big vat where they dip them in? Like how the Jack Nicholson became the Joker kind of style?
No, quicklime is like more like dirt sort of. Uh-huh. So like it was just like a pot mound with like corpses stuck inside.
Oh, so
it's like,
so you throw a body on there and then you just like, and get your shovel, put some quick lime on top there.
Yeah, so a whole nother room that they hadn't seen before, right? Mm-hmm. And then in a nearby stable, they found, another pile of bodies, a pit also filled with quick lime and corpses. They found shovels, hatchets, sacks of dismembered corpses, disemboweled corpses, headless corpses. So like,
what are we talking about? Like 300 dead bodies?
No, it's pieces. So it's really hard to tell. And so no, not 300, but just like a lot of just random stuff. I think if I were to say, I guess I should say there's a really wide estimate that doesn't go over 100.
You know, this thing where like Dexter's a serial killer and he only goes after the bad guys, or like Quentin Tarantino sort of revisionist history where he's like, you know, let's have Nazis get hunted and have the killers be sadistic, but like that's okay because they're killing Nazis. That is all such fantasy. Anyone who's going to be a sadistic person doesn't care who they're killing. They just want to be sadistic. And I know that as a fact because I have a PhD in the subject matter.
All right. So they're just like seeing it. It's not like this is kind of hard to explain. It's like nobody knows really how many. It's just like pieces. Mm-hmm. So it kind of is hard to, it's not like full bodies.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
But they're kind of like, this is a lot. Right. Yeah. And then also like, are we sure this is all German? Like, yeah, how would we know that?
How would you
right?
know?
So the big boss in charge arrives on the scene, Commissaire Massu. And so that's like the, I don't know, Detective Massu.
Okay, great.
And, you know, they start seeing a few other things besides bodies. They see, there's this big double sink in the basement. It's big enough to lay a body in and drain all the blood. And, you know, they see this little passageway that's connected to the doctor's office. And down the passageway, they find this really frightening, unexplained small triangular room. It's about 6 by 8 feet, totally empty, with 8 big iron rings mounted into the wall and no doorknob or light switch on the inside.
Oh, so it's straight up torture room.
On one side of the room, there were 2 heavy wooden doors that, based on like how the house is built, mm-hmm. they look like they led out into the street. And then next to the door was a doorbell. But when investigators opened the doors, they came face to face with another wall. It was a false exit. Mm-hmm. And then they realized the doorbell was totally fake. It wasn't wired to anything. Mm-hmm. And then underneath the wallpaper on another wall, they found a one-way peephole that was 6 feet off the ground. So if you stood in a stable on the other side of the wall, you could see inside the room, and it was magnified. Mm-hmm. So if you stood near the iron rings and put your arms up, if you looked through the peephole, it would magnify the person's face who was like standing.
Oh, so you get a really good IMAX vision of whoever you're torturing?
But for the record, the room looked entirely unused. There weren't any like marks of struggle inside. And it looked like the peephole had been papered over for years. So just for the record, no one ever figured out what the purpose for that room was. Like, to this day, nobody knows, but mm-hmm. it was just very strange.
Come on. We know what the purpose of, whether they used it for that purpose or not. You know what I mean? Like, I have that weight bench over there and those weights. Everyone knows what the purpose of those are. Have I lifted weights since I bought that in the beginning of COVID? No, but it's there.
Okay.
What's the purpose? Nick, I wonder.
Okay,
no
okay,
one
okay,
knows.
Okay. So at this point, the Germans get word of the bodies at 21 Rue Le Cerf, and they send word to French investigators. They send a telegram. So the French investigators were wrapping up the scene when they got a telegram from headquarters, and it says, order from German authorities, arrest Petiot, dangerous lunatic.
What's that? How do you say that in French? I bet you it sounds amazing. That's such a great phrase, dangerous lunatic.
So here's the thing.
Yeah.
Even though this all looks pretty bad and lunatic-y, the French police were always hesitant when it came to following German orders to arrest French citizens.
Yeah.
As the occupation dragged on, they found, obviously, when German officials wanted them to arrest someone, it was usually more for political reasons than for any like policing reasons. Often those targeted by Germans were simply people, you know, with an allegiance to France or whatever. So the company mm-hmm. line was to be super incompetent anytime the Germans sent down an order. So when this dangerous lunatic telegram came down the pipeline, it bolstered the feeling among French investigators that Dr. Patou was a resistance fighter and not a sadistic serial killer.
Uh-huh.
And instead of ramping up their search for Patou, Commissaire Massu went home and went to bed. That continued on into the next morning. Instead of canvassing train stations looking for Patou,
he slept in and ate a croissant.
They went to go like talk to the princess who used to like own the house. And yeah. She was like, I don't know, I sold the house 15 years ago. And they were like, good, good. And then they talked to a delivery guy who went there once, and he was like, I don't know, man. I don't know that guy. They talked to the architect who built the walls around the courtyard, like whatever, right? And eventually, though, the Germans start to get annoyed, right? They're like, come on, man. You got to, what's up? Like, you guys aren't catching this guy. And looking into Batu's file, Commissaire Massu maybe got a clue as to why. Batu had been arrested by the Germans before and held captive for 8 months before being released. Mm. That had just happened the year prior. Mm-hmm. But the Germans wouldn't say what he was arrested for. So the mystery deepened, but it seemed like maybe something was up and it was not so great, right? Like, mm-hmm. they're like, okay, well, what is going on, right? Because if he was like a resistance fighter and the Germans had him,
they wouldn't have let him out.
Right.
Right.
So like, what was he held for? Yeah, what do the Germans know?
He was like, don't worry, Germans. I'm just torturing and murdering French people.
Right. So we don't know. At the time, French newspapers were basically propaganda machines for the Germans and Gestapo recruiting ads, essentially. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there wasn't much going on. So the Germans were totally fine letting the Batu stuff fly. So the story became national front page news and pretty much the only news, really. Mm-hmm. So it was largely, and it was largely like pretty tabloidy. People were just out there making stuff up, but it was just everything that like, everything that you would read in the paper was just all murder doctor. Right?
Yeah, it's like, forget the war. We right. all need a break from the World War II. Let's
that
just
we are causing. Yeah, everybody right. don't pay attention to all the horrific stuff we're doing.
Think about the triangle room. What was horrific... its purpose?
Yeah, Jesus. Like people were writing, oh, the victims were all women, and Batu was a drug addict who performed abortions, that he murdered all the women by outlandish means in the triangular chamber, and then he made them all stand in a pit of lie and dissolve while they were still alive, and like none of that stuff was true, but it definitely was, you know, terrifying. Sure. So that was like, you know, gripping the country.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, French inspectors continued to half-ass the investigation for their country. They managed to not find a single usable fingerprint in the princess house or Batu's other apartment. Uh-huh. They took an inventory of the basement at the princess house. They found 22 used toothbrushes, 15 women's combs, 7 pocket combs, 9 nail files, 5 gas masks, 7 pairs of eyeglasses, like a black satin evening gown. So kind of a weird array of things.
Well, the way you phrase some of that, it also does seem like feminine stuff.
Yeah, but it wasn't all women.
Okay.
Yeah. They got to work reassembling some of the remains. They found at least 10 victims, 5 men and 5 women, ranging from 25 to 55. But then they also had like 5 kilograms of hair and more than 10 human scalps, plus 15 kilograms of charred bone fragments. So there were definitely more than 10 mm-hmm. victims.
What does that mean, kilograms of hair? How was that like a gigantic amount? Or I don't even know what that means nothing to me.
You know, I don't really know either. I think it's like about, it's like 13 pounds of hair, you know? And I think it's like, mm-hmm. if it's half men, half women, I think 13 pounds of hair would be a lot of hair if you're talking about men.
Well, I know when I have really long hair and I'll pull what to me seems like the most amount of hair of all time out of like my brush or whatever. And it probably weighs 0.0000000.1 pounds. And to me, it's like as big as my head almost. So 10 pounds of hair, it sounds like the size of a building. It sounds huge. Lots of hair. Well, they found a lot of hair.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, but that's a good question. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're being very scientific, but no. It seems like...
Were we supposed to be? Oh, dear God.
It just seemed like there was a lot of stuff happening.
Okay.
Like a lot of...
like they cut the hair off and it wasn't burned or whatever.
I think outside of the victims mm-hmm. that they were able to piece back together... then there's just like an extra, you know, 13 pounds of hair. And they're like, okay, well, that's a weird extra thing.
Yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I'm saying? So that's like, I think that that's what they're finding. Yeah, right. And then this, things are burned and they're also dissolved.
Yeah.
So it's just like really hard to tell what, like yeah. what happened.
Yeah.
Identification was pretty much impossible. All the bodies had been badly dissolved by the quicklime, and then their faces and scalps, what they found, had all been stripped off in one piece, like systematically. Mm. There weren't any visible wounds like stab wounds or gunshots. And they had been dissected by someone who knew about anatomy, but in a really weird way. Like a doctor would typically make cuts at the joints of the body, right? The person who had cut these bodies had cut out whole pieces of the bodies in pieces, almost like how you'd carve a chicken into quarters. So that's how mm-hmm. they had cut the body. And it was thought that the bodies had been around, some of them had been around for close to a year, and that they had been bled dry before being placed in the quicklime. So this mm-hmm. had been something that had been happening for a long time. Anyway, because of all that, in the end, it was just pretty much impossible to tell how many bodies they were working
mm-hmm,
with.
Mm-hmm.
The coroner working the case, though, had a lot of questions because he recognized some of the techniques in terms of like cutting up the bodies mm-hmm. and removing the scalps from another case. He had seen these techniques before. They were techniques used on about 12 human remains found in the River Seine in 1942 and 1943. So the killer who murdered these 12 mm-hmm. people, he got away. They never caught him. He was almost caught because they think that they found the guy because he threw a human hand off a bridge and it hit a barge. And so people saw this guy throwing a human hand off the yeah. off this bridge.
That guy.
Yeah. And they chased him, but he got away. The bodies were never identified because the killer had stripped the fingerprints off the bodies and had peeled the victims' faces and scalps off in one piece. He had also cut them up in quarters like a chicken
yeah.
in the same way. But there was this other thing. Back then, and maybe still today, I don't know. I don't probably think not today anymore. Coroners used to use the thighs in bodies kind of like pin cushions. So they would like stick their instruments in them whenever they needed to switch tools while they were doing an autopsy.
I bet you like two coroners did that. I feel like
this guy was like this master coroner, so he used to teach students like this technique of like using the thighs as pin cushions. And so when he saw in the bodies in the river, and he saw that they had similar puncture wounds, he was like low-key kind of worried that one of his students was doing the murders.
Oh, okay, okay.
And then when they go to the princess house to try to piece these bodies back together, he saw the same puncture wounds in the thighs of these bodies. So he was like, he saw the same exact techniques used on these bodies from the river as they were seeing at
horrific.
The princess house. Yeah. So armed with all of this information, Commissaire Massu decided to look further into Dr. Patu's record just to see what he was working with. Like, what was this resistance fighter mm-hmm. up to, right? What was this hero up to? And he found not only did Dr. Patu have some fairly recent narcotics charges, the people set to testify against him had mysteriously disappeared. He was convicted of over-prescribing heroin to addicts twice, like fairly recently, and twice sentenced to suspended prison time and a fine. So in one instance, Patu was accused of not thoroughly examining a patient before prescribing heroin, and that patient disappeared without a trace before the trial after a scheduled meeting with Patu. 10 days later, Patu showed up to the police station miraculously, having found a record of a physical examination so thorough, he had even measured the length of this patient's penis, right? He had said, oh, wait, I did do the whole thing. And like, it's crazy. Here you go. And this is how long his penis is.
Well, how long was it?
He didn't say.
Oh, Muriel, how are you going to dangle that carrot then not give us how many inches the carrot is, you know?
In another case, they did say, though, that it was so disturbingly thorough, it seemed more like a post-mortem than like a physical examination. In another case, a witness claimed Patu gave her false injections to cover for her heroin-addicted daughter. It was basically like he was accused of giving her daughter too much heroin, and then he was trying to get her to like say, oh, actually it was for me, I'm an addict, and like get, so he was like, come to my office, I'm just gonna give you injection marks, mm-hmm. so then you can say like, look at me, I'm also a heroin addict,
right?
And she went in and did it, and then after that she talked to a friend and she decided that was like unethical, right? So she decided she was gonna go to police and report Patu. But after she decided to do that and she was going to go tell Patu she's not going to go through the scheme, she also disappeared without a trace. And between those two people, there was like, based on like family sort of like pressure, there was a brief investigation into Dr. Patu. Police searched his office. It was really like a half-ass investigation. They searched his office and like didn't really do much. They asked him a few questions. And then in his desk, they found like piles of gold and jewelry. And Dr. Patu said, oh, that's just how my poorer patients pay me. Because they don't have a lot of money. They give me heirlooms. And the police were like, okay, sounds good. And then they just closed the case. So that was the end of that. Is these people disappeared and they found his house was full of jewels.
All checks out here.
Yeah, all checks out here. So,
voila.
By Monday, March 13th, they really started looking for Dr. Marcel Patu for real, right? Something felt super whack about the situation. Investigators had some addresses to go off, family and friends of the couple. And so they went first to Dr. Patu's brother's house in Yan province, about 2 hours outside of Paris. And the house was similar to the princess house, again, filled with like discarded furniture and hoarder stuff, tons of clothes and furniture and junk. Maurice, like his brother, was known to buy up lots of different stuff at auction and elsewhere, furniture, jewelry, and then also tons of real estate in his name and his wife and children's names. He spent most of his life failing in business, selling radios and bicycles. So people always were questioning how he got his money. The rumor was he had recently had a lot of luck playing the American stock market just previous to the World War II. And so he had somehow hit on something and made a lot of money. So they found Maurice in his radio store working, and Maurice was just totally freaked out. He hadn't shaved or showered, hadn't slept. And, you know, like we said, there are these stories. That's what everybody knows, is these like newspaper stories. And he just couldn't believe what he was hearing about his brother in the press. Everyone who knows Dr. Patu has been like reading these horrific things. And, you know, he tells police he hasn't heard from his brother since the month prior in February. You know, he knew about the princess house in Paris, but he had never been there in person. But really quickly, some very quick digging revealed not only had Maurice been to the princess house, but he had helped deliver 400 kilograms of quicklime to the house in February. So when presented with that information, Maurice is like, oh my, you know, oh yeah, my brother asked for the quicklime because he was trying to exterminate some roaches and maybe whitewash some fences. I had no idea it was for dissolving bodies. Shocked. So he was charged with conspiracy to commit murder and arrested. And so the next they go, obviously, for Dr. Patu's wife, Georgette. They find her at a local train station. She's waiting for a train, haggard, exhausted, obviously hasn't slept, been reading the same newspaper stories. And they arrest her, bring her to the police station as well. And at the police station, she tells her stories. Like Maurice, Georgette claimed to be absolutely blindsided by her husband's alleged mass murders. You know, she says, oh, I've only been to the princess house once years ago. You know, she said the last time she saw her husband was the day the bodies were discovered and he never came home. Mm-hmm. So since then, she had just wandered around Paris, lost and grief stricken, reading the newspapers about what he had done. She told police she was too afraid to stay alone in the apartment. So she just like hadn't gone home. She had spent like one entire day just like at church, going to different church services, mm-hmm. and then spent another entire day sitting in the alcove of an apartment building, and then another full day in a restaurant.
Well, and that sounds like a pretty reasonable reaction.
Yeah, right. And then she finishes telling her story, and then she just like collapses and faints in the, you know, police station.
And a pile of scalps spill out of her purse.
Yeah. So at the Paris apartment, Georgette shared with her husband, investigators found an inordinate amount of heroin and morphine, like even for an old-timey doctor, that was way too much,
yeah.
As well as a set of male and female genitalia preserved in jars, and a wooden sculpture the doctor made himself of a half-man, half-animal with a gigantic wiener.
Nice.
They didn't have much to hold Georgette on. They ended up finding she had no proof of ownership of a 5-carat diamond ring she said the doctor had given her. So they indicted her for accepting stolen goods. They're just trying to kind of keep everybody together, right?
Yeah.
Also, randomly, when she was fingerprinted, they found her prints spiraled in the opposite direction of every other print they had on record. Plus, she had a 6th finger on each hand amputated at birth, something that newspapers were quick to tell the public meant she was hella evil.
I mean, that sounds pretty crazy. I'm not even saying evil is bad, you know? So if you're out there and you have your spirals going in, like how the Australian toilets go the other direction, that's your fingertip status, and you had 6. And just because you're born evil doesn't mean I don't love you.
Yeah, right. You know? Yeah, that's pretty intense. Omen shit over there. All right. Now, investigators had, as far as they knew, the two people closest to Dr. Patu. But that would soon change with more information from the Germans. March 15th, 4 days after the discovery of the bodies, Commissaire Massu got more information about Dr. Patius' earlier arrest from the Germans. Sometime in early 1943, the Germans got word about an escape organization being run out of a barbershop in Paris. They were supposedly smuggling Jews fleeing the Holocaust and downed pilots from Allied forces out of France using false ID papers. So two men, Edmond Pintard, an out-of-work vaudevillian actor, and a man named Raoul Fourier, a barber, were known members of this escape organization. And it was led by a shadowy doctor no one knew anything about, named Dr. Eugene. So the Gestapo arrested the barber and vaudevillian actor on May 21st, 1943, and they beat them until they gave them Dr. Eugene's real name, Dr. Marcel Patu. Then they arrested Dr. Patu at his Paris apartment, along with a friend of his who was also at the apartment to give the Patus some tickets to a smashing new musical comedy. So the friend with the tickets, René Nezandet, was released after 2 weeks when it became obvious he knew nothing. And the three other men were held and tortured for 8 months and released in January of 1944. So this new bit of info really freaked Commissaire Massu out. Now, can you guess why?
No.
Well, what if Dr. Patu's victims came from this alleged escape organization? What if he's been luring the most vulnerable, desperate people in France into a barbershop, murdering them, and then stealing all of their worldly possessions, their jewels, and their money?
Well, that sounds like that would align with the person who would also gut them and burn them and completely torture them. So it seems like the leading theory.
So as soon as the question formed in his mind, and before he had a chance to look into anything, Massu got a visit from someone with an interesting story. The same afternoon, he spoke with the Germans. A local man, Jean Goudot, came in to talk about his missing friend. Jean had read all the news about Dr. Patu and the bodies and wanted to tell police his own story regarding the doctor. He said he used to own a fur shop with a Jewish man named Gushinov at the beginning of the war. And in 1941, after the German occupation of France, Gushinov was seeing the increased hostility toward Jews and wanted to get out of Europe. And he told Jean his neighbor, Dr. Patu, could get him a fake Argentinian passport and get him to South America for 25,000 francs. Jean said he helped Gushinov pack for the trip, following Dr. Patu's instructions to the letter, which was to remove all identifiable markings from his clothes, pack super light, bring his finest furs, gold jewelry, diamonds, and then all of his cash, which he was supposed to sew into the shoulder pads of his coat. Gushinov left his wife in Paris and went alone and then was never seen again. Dr. Patu showed Gushinov's wife a few letters, basically that Patu said were from her husband, showing that he made it to Buenos Aires. But the letters eventually stopped. And then because they were Jewish, living in occupied France, Gushinov's wife never reported him missing to the authorities. And so he just disappeared kind of without a word.
Yeah.
So now with this information, it seemed like if investigators couldn't find Dr. Patu, the next best thing was going to be talking to the three men involved in this so-called escape organization. The first one they snagged was René Nezendet, the guy with the theater tickets. Mm-hmm. This is a little complicated, but basically after the news of Dr. Patu and the mass killings hit the papers, a few people showed up to police station and shared similar stories that basically way before these stories about Dr. Patu hit the papers, René Nezendet came to them and was like, "Hey, I know this guy, Dr. Patu. He's out there killing all these people and robbing them. And I've seen the bodies myself. It's crazy, man." So basically, mm-hmm. people kept coming to police after and saying like, "Oh, this guy knows something."
Right? Yeah.
So investigators go, they haul Nezendet in, and this is this is his story kind of all condensed.
Sure.
Okay. So he was mistakenly arrested along with Dr. Patu in May 1943 in connection with the alleged escape organization. The Germans quickly realized Nezendet had nothing to do with the plot and made plans to release him. And Nezendet said a few days before he was released from the custody of the Germans, he was alone for a moment with Dr. Patu, who whispered, "Tell my wife to go where she knows to go and dig up what is hidden there." Then, right before his release from the Germans, Dr. Patu told Nezendet, not Dr. Patu's release, Nezendet's release. Dr. Patu told Nezendet, "Never mind, forget it. Don't tell Georgette anything," right? Well, for reasons that are not at all clear, Nezendet decided to pass on the message anyway. Mm-hmm. So after he was released, he So weird. He called Georgette and left an anonymous message telling her to make a sandwich and go to a local metro station. So Georgette did, and she goes to the metro station and she waits, and then Nezindet shows up there, takes the sandwich, eats the sandwich, starving. And then he tells her,
"Make this is an anonymous thing. Make me a picnic."
And then he goes and he's like, "Hey, your husband told you to go dig up that thing." So Georgette had no idea what Nezindet was talking about. So she just passes that same message on to Dr. Petit's brother, Maurice. So according to Nezindet, Maurice figured the only place to dig for something would be at the grounds at the Princess House at 21 Rue Le Sueur. So he went there to see what he could dig up, and he found this nightmarish body pile and an enormous stash of luggage and clothing. Nezindet said that in the fall of 1943, while Dr. Patou was still in prison, that he met up with Maurice in a hotel, and Maurice was in terrible shape and he just spilled his guts. So he said at this hotel, this brother Maurice tells him, "Hey man, you know, we're in big trouble. I just discovered my brother is a murderer, that instead of sending people to South America, you know, Dr. Patou has been injecting them with poison and throwing them into a pit. I found all the records. It looks like there's 50 to 60 victims. And then Nezindet said Maurice panicked and he packed all of the clothing and suitcases up into crates and carted it away.
47 of them, maybe.
Nezindet then told police a few weeks later that he had dinner at the Patou apartment with Georgette and the brother Maurice. And they're all having dinner, acting like everything's normal. And Nezindet said he felt like Georgette needed to know. So he pulled her aside and told her about the bodies privately, right? And Nezindet said after he told Georgette, Georgette fainted 3 times and then threatened suicide. So dinner's over and they all break up.
Mm-hmm.
And later, you know, Georgette basically like doesn't believe the story and thinks Nezindet is making the whole thing up. And so she calls Maurice and Nezindet into a meeting and she says, "What is he talking about?" And in this meeting, Maurice basically says, "Nezindet is making this whole thing up. I don't know what he's talking about. It's mm-hmm. all fake." And in this meeting, Georgette decides that Nezindet made the entire terrible story up to get into her pants while her husband is locked up by the Germans. And so they all dismiss him. So that's the whole story, right? That Nezindet has to say. And this implicates Maurice and Georgette pretty hard. As for Maurice and Georgette, they totally flat out deny it. They're, you know, and there's a lot of contradictions in Nezindet's story. Like, it's a little janky in some parts. The timeline wasn't quite right. And regardless, the whole story is kind of unable to be verified anyway. So ultimately, it was Nezindet's word against Maurice and Georgette. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody really knows exactly what happens. And Maurice and the Patou family straight up said Nezindet was a known idiot. So this is like a piece of all this. Like, Maurice's wife was like, "Listen, Nezindet is a, like a loudmouth and an idiot." Like, and to prove it, she told them this story about how Nezindet bought this field that he thought had buried treasure underneath it. And he had this like pendulum that he thought he could like, it was like magic and could
find a water stick or
yeah
whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he was like swinging it around and he said it found this treasure, so he bought a whole field, and then when he was digging for it, it showed that actually the treasure was in a different field. So then he dug a tunnel and tried to tunnel his way under the field to the other field to steal the treasure.
Yeah.
And then he found no treasure at all. And then the police were like, okay, well, they told us this story. And Nezindet was just like, I don't know what this has to do with anything. Like, that does not show that I'm an idiot. So Nezindet really, you know, he comes off as not being. And then he, like, at one point, it's just like, I don't care anymore. Like, yeah. At one point, he was like, I'm just going to say I didn't see it. Say
yeah,
it, you
right.
know, like,
it's way easier. I tried to do the right thing, I think.
Yeah. So
and now I'm tapping out.
So the investigation really was at a standstill. Like, no one knew exactly what was going on or who knew what at what time. They just used Nezindet's story to charge him with concealing a crime he witnessed or knew of. And they mm-hmm. gave him 14 months in prison. Again, just trying to keep everyone connected to the Patu case in the same place.
Yeah.
Next, Commissaire Massu went after Raul Fourier and Edmund Pintard, who had also been arrested in the escape operation sting. Pintard was 56 and all broke down, skinny, bad teeth, former vaudeville actor. He now did makeup for Paramount Pictures and, you know, smoke cigarettes and talk shit out in cafes.
Oh my God, he sounds like every SAG actor we know currently on strike.
Fourier was a 61-year-old barber, short and squat, topped with a beret. And they told police pretty much the exact same story. Like, and like everyone before them, they also claimed to be totally and completely blindsided by the murder part. Fourier was Dr. Patu's barber and had known him for about 7 years. And he said in the spring of 1941, Dr. Patu told him that, hey, man, I run this organization that can get people to South America for 25,000 francs per person, which really roughly I think is about $10,000 in today's money. And mm-hmm. that included all travel costs and false paperwork. And that was a really good deal. At the time, the average cost of a trip like that was actually usually around 50,000 francs. So it was about half the price that people were paying. Mm. It was almost impossible to make that journey without this huge, you know, international network.
Yeah.
And about 70% of the people trying to make the journey out of France at the time died on the way out.
Wow. It's crazy that Argentina was a place where people were going to hide from the Nazis, and then later it becomes a place where Nazis go to hide.
Yeah. So Fourier saw this really low cost of, you know, travel, like 25,000 francs was so low comparatively that he recognized it as a money-making opportunity, a way for him to skim from the top. So he got his old vaudevillian friend Pintard to help with recruiting people, and the two got to work bringing Dr. Patu a steady stream of clients. He thought, you know, I can inflate the price a little bit because it's already so low. Their first victims were generally career criminals, like often under German protection. And what they were doing is like in exchange for providing information, like they were getting protection from the Germans and in exchange for providing information or prostitutes or something like that. Or some of them worked as requisition officers. So they were like Frenchmen on the ground who purchased or just took valuables to fund the Nazi efforts, or gangs that organized stealing Jewish property. And the first victims included like the prostitutes in their entourages. Mm-hmm. Pintard's open call for the escape organization was like pretty obvious. He did it in a cafe, like vaudeville style. He was not like a subtle guy. And the
step right this way. Who needs to escape? Let's go. What about you, sir? Who's going away?
The Gestapo caught on quickly, but they were like stumped by this genius mystery doctor running things. They figured it was a complex international operation directed by high-level French officials.
Nope, just one dangerous lunatic.
In a Gestapo security file, they wrote, quote, according to my informants, the doctor in question does not deal solely with Jews, but with anyone who comes to him. And it is said that he has abetted the escape of certain suspicious persons, notably terrorists and even army deserters. The voyagers travel on neutral ships leaving from a port in Portugal. They are sent there by rail via Irun. The long and fastidious investigation which I have made shows that this network is organized in a remarkable fashion and takes infinite precautions to avoid crossover or communication between adjacent cells in the network's hierarchy.
Really? They're just all just showing up at a basement and getting murdered?
Eventually, they caught Pintard and Fourier in a sting operation and beat them until they revealed Dr. Patu's identity and location. They then arrested Dr. Patu and the confused theater-going Nezindet. Dr. Patu was tortured for 3 days straight, dunked in an ice bath, head crushed with iron bands. His teeth were filed down. Oof. They showed him a corpse and said it was one of his co-conspirators. But Dr. Patu didn't give up a single thing about the escape operation, only that he was a part of it. And that the actual trips were organized by a man he knew as Robert Martinetti, and that was it. The three men were held for 8 months, and for some reason, this whole time, the Germans didn't realize Dr. Patu owned a whole-ass other house. Like, there were records and bills for the Princess House. It was totally, like, on the books as something that he owned. It wasn't a secret house or anything like that. And if they had checked it, according to Nezindet, they would have found dozens of bodies.
Yeah.
Pintard and Fourier were released on January 11th, 1944. After spilling their guts to Germans, the Germans realized them and really didn't know anything, and they let them go. Dr. Patu was released 2 days later, and really, no one to this day knows why. It was way more the German way to just shoot him. Some think he may have agreed to work for the Gestapo, or that, you know, maybe he told them the truth, that he had just been murdering French people and Jewish people, and that the Germans were totally fine with that, you know, or that maybe they released him with the intention of putting him under surveillance and finding the rest of the resistance group. You know, nobody really knew. But, you know, that's the way it went. They released him into the custody of his family. And then 2 months later, police found a horror show of piles of burning and decomposing bodies in his house in the posh 16th arrondissement, and they sent a telegram saying, "Dr. Patu, lunatic, arrest him immediately." So they had to know something, you know? So now police had most of the people involved with Patu in custody, all of them claiming ignorance. There was literally a mountain of evidence, and no one knew where Dr. Patu was. At this point, police had accounted for about 9 missing people. Like, they could trace their journey, and they knew that they were probably among the dead. But Patu had mentioned at least 3 other quote-unquote voyages to South America. The body parts at the house far exceeded 9 people, and the volume of personal objects found at the Prince's house looked to belong to way, way more than 9 people. Investigators went back to speak with neighbors, and they kept hearing the same thing, this weird thing that neighbors kept mentioning, seeing Dr. Patu at the house during the time they knew for sure that he was in this German prison. Mm. Even the lady who said she'd counted Dr. Patu moving 47 suitcases, and they couldn't figure it out until one neighbor was like, "Oh, I went to drop off some mail at the house once, and I was halfway through a conversation with him when I realized I wasn't talking to the doctor. I was talking to his brother, Maurice, because they looked really similar." And it clicked. "Mister, I only went to the house once to drop off 400 kilograms of quicklime, had been over there all the time while Dr. Patu was in prison, going in and out of the house, moving suitcases." Investigators went digging and found a record of Maurice shipping 45 suitcases out of Paris 5 days after his brother was arrested by the Germans. Confronted with this, he's like, okay, yes, listen. After Georgette got that weird message from Nezindet, I went back to the Princess House to see if I could find anything, and I didn't find any bodies. But I found all these clothes But that wasn't weird because the doctor was always buying things at auction.
Yeah.
One time he bought 300 raincoats, you know, it's crazy. So I took everything because I thought if the Germans searched the place, they'd take all the clothes and my brother would be pissed. So I don't know about that, right? I also want to add in there that Nezindet wasn't released from prison until 2 weeks after his arrest. So Maurice's timeline still doesn't make
sense. Sure, yeah.
Anyhow, the suitcases were being stored in the attic of a friend's house. So the police go to the friend's house. They arrest a friend. They arrest the friend's wife. They go to requisition the suitcases and they find, wait for it, the whole family had been skimming from the suitcases for months. Georgette's dad's mistress had taken stuff. Maurice's family had taken stuff. Georgette had some furs from one of the missing people. 8 suitcases were straight up missing. And then there were also 12 new ones that weren't a part of the original shipment.
Mm-hmm.
So that would mean sometime in the 2 months between when Dr. Patou was released from the German prison and the bodies were found, that's like 12 new suitcases mm-hmm. were accumulated.
Yeah. They're just on a tear.
Yeah. And just, you know, also take into consideration, victims were told to pack light and in some cases not bring a suitcase in at all. Police found a total between both houses, a total of 83 suitcases with contents weighing over 3 tons.
Mm.
Some clothing was even monogrammed with some of the missing victims' initials.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Obviously, this is all that they're just stealing the people's best stuff, which I think was a very common tactic at the time. I think a lot of people were told, pack really light and only bring what you actually care about.
Yeah. But everyone in this crew maintained ignorance. Oh, we thought it was just auction clothes. Oh, these things got mixed up with one of my suitcases. Mm-hmm. That's why the scarf is in my stuff. Oh, mm-hmm. the roof leaked on some of my suitcases, or some of the suitcases. So I took some of these luxury items out to wash and I just forgot to put them back in the suitcases. You know, everyone kept changing their story, but never really admitting anything.
Mm-hmm.
The investigation of the contents of the suitcases was hampered by the war and the German occupation. The communication was awful between the Germans and the French, and really just impossible between the French and other countries and other regions of France. The French police sent letters to every police department in France, hoping to suss out local markings from like laundries and tailors and stuff like that, but they heard nothing back. But the press was really helpful. Families and friends started to write in about missing people who had tried to flee France to South America with the help of a mysterious doctor who had then just disappeared, right? Mm-hmm. And now police were starting to see a different picture of the victims, less seedy underworld types and more Jewish families desperate to escape Nazi persecution. Families who had already lost so much and gone through so much just to survive the journey to Paris, spending their last bit of money on a passage out of the country only to be murdered and robbed by Dr. Patou. As the investigation unfolded, they found there was this whole network working for Patou. He even had someone posing as his secretary and then multiple recruiters. It all seemed very formal. He had a whole like structure of how this would work. He would make people wait until there was space available, tell them he was doing a huge favor for them, you know, like really talk up the whole mm-hmm, situation. Mm-hmm. He would make them hide like for 48 hours. There was a waiting period during which they had to have these like required injections, like for like health reasons to like get into the country, like inoculations. And then again, everyone had to take the most money they possibly could and the least amount of luggage. And he always had them sew their cash into the same place, into the shoulders mm-hmm. of their jackets. And then afterwards, families would receive letters from their loved ones. And often the letters would have the wrong spelling of their name or strange grammar, uncharacteristic phrasing, or the handwriting would be strange, distorted, or in some cases, just straight up clearly someone else's handwriting. Yeah. And, you know, there were people speaking to investigators who were really helpful. There were people who pulled out at the last minute. So they survived to tell police about their doubts and like got a firsthand account of what it was like, mm-hmm. right? That they pulled out because he was kind of strange and rambling. Like one family with one of the parents was a doctor, was like, I started talking to him about medicine, mm-hmm. and he didn't know anything yeah. about
he's
medicine.
Like, oh, you mean heroin?
Kind
They're
of.
Like, no, the inoculation you're talking about that I need to like be in this room for 48 hours.
He's just like going. And he's like, I looked at him and his hands were just like caked in dirt and grease and Oof. His fingernails were disgusting. And he was just like, this is just, there's too many red flags.
Yeah.
And they pulled out. So next week, we finally find Dr. Batu.
The scourge of, this is the worst. He's like actually the most sadistic of the most sadistic.
Yeah. So he.
Yeah.
In the brief months after the discovery of the bodies at his Rue Lacerre home.
Yeah.
Had joined the French forces of the interior and risen to the rank of captain under a fake name. In fact, at the time of his arrest, he was in charge of counter-espionage and interrogations for the FFI, working with the French army, and was actually tapped by French investigators to join the task force searching for him.
Oh my God.
Will also, it's like, what is this life?
He's like, hold on. Oh, we think this guy can lead us to Dr. Pato. Hold on, leave us alone. I'm going to torture him for a while until I get the answer.
We'll also hear Dr. Pato's version of events.
Uh-huh.
His own version of events.
Yes.
Which involve a top secret branch of the French resistance.
Okay.
And an independent murder squad called Fly Talks. And the most absurd murder trial I've ever encountered in my life. Plus, a good old-fashioned French beheading.
Oh, good. It wouldn't be France without one of those. Thank you so much for listening to Muriel's Murders. We're going to have part two out next week and a little earlier on the subscription feeds. Find us on Patreon or through Spotify. If you love this podcast, hit us up.
All right, baby. Mario Casolini did all our music. You can find him at Casolini Beats on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, thanks so much for listening to us. Our DMs are always open. You can email us. I got a lot of really good suggestions in yeah. the last couple of weeks, so I'm going to start tapping those soon. So thank you. I love getting them. And, you know, sometimes I have, like, episodes planned out for a while, so it takes mm-hmm. me a while to integrate them. But I am, and I'm grateful to you.
All right. We are very grateful to you. We love you so much. And take care in this wild, wild world. And we'll see you soon.
Bye.